Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. This week, Donald Trump's Electric Avenue fair use failure. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to take a look back at some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when, there were two big stories in the music world that we're not really sure are suitable entirely for a full setlist discussion, but we should probably acknowledge because they've both been very big stories. The first was the conviction of R. Kelly on a variety of sexual abuse-related charges. And then there was the court decision to remove Britney Spears' father, Jamie Spears, from the conservatorship that she's been governed by for the last 13 years.
So as you say, those were both headline-grabbing stories in the last 7 days that we have been covering extensively in the CMU Daily in recent weeks and months. So if you're interested in either of those stories, do check out the coverage on the website. But yes, well, one of them is far too distressing and depressing to be chatting about in a jovial way on the podcast. And actually, even the Britney story, A, it's quite complicated, and B, if the allegations about the way Britney's conservatorship has been run are true and the way that she's been treated throughout are true, that's quite distressing too. But we don't feel that either of those are really appropriate for setlist treatment. Go and read about them on the website.
I mean, I think there is a discussion to be had about the business implications of both of them. And I think you can find those discussions online, but I don't think we particularly want to spend the next 45 minutes talking about something that's definitely not the most important thing about either of those two stories.
And so therefore, we have selected some other stories which were not quite as big in the headlines, it has to be said, but which are more in usual setlist chatter territory.
Yeah, later on we will be discussing the attempt to have the cover of Nirvana's Nevermind censored. But first, a judge in New York has declined to dismiss Eddie Grant's copyright infringement lawsuit against Donald Trump over the use of Grant's track Electric Avenue in one of Trump's campaign videos last year. Trump's team claimed that their use of the song was transformative and therefore covered by the fair use principle in US copyright law, but the judge has concluded that the former president is yet to demonstrate that his use of the song was in any way fair use.
Yes, so as we've discussed on numerous occasions, I am sure, here on Setlist, and we've definitely written about it a huge amount in the CMU
Daily. We probably thought we'd never have to talk about it again.
When Donald Trump was president, and of course in the long drawn out campaign that preceded his presidency, throughout that period, when Donald Trump was doing the politics thing, I mean, he's still doing the politics thing, isn't he? In that he still has his rallies. Does he still play music at those rallies? I think he probably does, but
no one's paying attention anymore.
Well, exactly. Nobody except his absolute base are paying attention to those things anymore. So nobody cares. But throughout Trump's presidential election campaign, the original
you
campaign.
You made absolute base sound like a real insult there. Sorry.
Well, you know what I mean.
Yes.
So, my point is
throughout
Trump's original presidential election campaign and then his presidency and then, of course, his second election campaign, his re-election campaign, numerous, countless, I would almost say, partly so I don't have to count them, countless artists complained because Donald Trump had used one of their tracks, one of their songs, usually at his political events, at his rallies. So it kind of became pretty standard that in amongst Trump getting on stage and waffling endlessly about nonsense, there would usually be some music playing before and after. And I mean, there were some weird musical choices along the way, weren't there? In that by the re-election campaign in 2020, YMCA had sort of become his anthem.
Yeah.
Which, given everything that he stands for and what his supporters stand for, and given the history of YMCA, was just bizarre. But the point was, at lots of his events, he used tracks, and whenever that happened, well, was it every single time? Are there any musicians who like Donald Trump? There are a couple, I guess. But in most cases, whenever he played a track at one of his rallies, it would ultimately result in that artist getting on the social media and saying, I'm not happy with Donald Trump using my music. I'm outraged. It should stop. I want him to stop using my tracks at his events.
Yeah, and in that context, Trump wouldn't usually need specific permission to play any one track, providing that his campaign or the venue hosting the event had the correct blanket license in place to cover the use of music at such events. So, I mean, exactly what artists could do beyond going on social media and saying, please don't do that, was not always entirely clear. Although there were attempts to go legal with it and put through arguments saying that he wasn't covered by the correct licenses to use certain pieces of music. Neil Young was one of the artists who actually went legal over it and was very outspoken against Trump anyway, so he was very annoyed when Trump was still using his music 4 years after Neil Young had first said, just stop doing that now. But I don't think any of those cases have ever actually got as far as going to court.
No, and as you said, obviously when you're organising an event, usually you would get a blanket license from a collecting society, or in the US, obviously there are multiple collecting societies, but providing you had your ASCAP and your BMI license and a CSEC license and a GMR license, then you're probably covered. It did transpire as the Trump presidency went on that political events are technically meant to get their own license rather than relying on the venue's license. And of course, sometimes political events happen in unusual places where the building where they're taking place wouldn't necessarily have its own license. And with the specific political license, technically artists, songwriters can pull out of that license, and then Trump couldn't rely on the blanket licenses for those songs. But by the time everyone had started sort of investigating the nitty-gritty of that and then saying to the Trump campaign, FYI, we have pulled out of the political license for ASCAP or BMI or whoever, stop using our music. By the time everyone was kind of getting onto that from a legal perspective, rather than just moaning about it on social media, the Trump presidency was over. So, I don't think any of those threats of legal action, with the exception of Neil Young, ever actually resulted in legal action. Although there was talk, wasn't there, of the label that has the Village People catalogue, which are actually based in France, going legal as well. But this case, which, as we will explain in a moment, is a little bit different, I think is the one case that is properly now in court and going through the motions.
Yeah, because in Eddie Grant's case, it wasn't that Trump used his music at a rally. It was that he used the song Electric Avenue in a campaign video that was posted to Twitter. And that kind of usage is not covered by any of the blanket licenses issued by collecting societies. And the campaign, therefore, would need to go and get a bespoke license specifically for the use of that track, which it did not. And so Eddie Grant sued over this in September 2020, and his lawsuit stated that neither he nor his companies nor any agent on their respective behalves had licensed any rights in Electric Avenue, either on the publishing or the recording side, to Donald Trump or his campaign organisation, or otherwise consented in any way to the use of the track in connection with the infringing video. It was very specific to cover all bases here. Basically just said in a very long-winded way, we didn't grant a license, we were never asked, and we would not have granted one anyway. But last November, Donald Trump's lawyers, who were always busy, filed a motion back arguing that actually they didn't need a license because the use of Electric Avenue in a campaign video, alongside out-of-context excerpts of Joe Biden's past speeches and interviews, was in fact covered by fair use.
Yeah, so crucially, Trump's team were not suggesting that this video, like the events, was covered by any blanket licenses, BMI ASCAP licenses, because it's not. So they were right not to make that claim. Clearly, they didn't sort out any bespoke licenses, because that's not what they're claiming. They're not claiming, well, we spoke to this person and we got clearance from that person. They basically came to court with the classic fair use defense. So we've talked about fair use before. On Setlist, it's a specific principle that exists in American copyright law. Related principles are found in copyright all around the world. I mean, basically what copyright law does is it gives creative people and their business partners control over the output of their creativity. That's what copyright is all about. So you write a song. Because of copyright, you have control over what happens to that song. You record a track. Because of copyright, you have control over what happens to that track. But then copyright law limits those controls in one way or another. So in Europe, with European copyright systems, we tend to talk about copyright exceptions. There are specific scenarios where the control that comes with the copyright do not apply. So a common one is critical analysis. If you play a little bit of music in order to critique it, providing it's a snippet of the music, providing you do then critique the music, then you probably don't need to get permission from whoever controls the song rights or the recording rights, because you're covered by a copyright exception, the critical analysis exception. Another common exception is the parody exception. If you take somebody's song and you use it, but maybe you change the lyrics to mock somebody, maybe it's mocking the artist themselves, then often you don't need to get permission, you don't need a license because of the parody exception. So you get those exceptions in most copyright systems, all of them, I would expect. But under US copyright law, we have this very wide and ambiguous exception called fair use that basically says if your use of a copyright work is fair, then you don't need to get a license. You don't need to get permission. Well, what the hell does that mean? Now, copyright law in the US, and certainly precedent in various cases that have gone to court, because basically whenever anyone is accused of copyright infringement in the US, nearly always the first thing they say is, oh, that was fair use, just like Donald Trump's team have done. So it has been tested in court. There are some guidelines on what might constitute fair use. But even with those guidelines, it is quite ambiguous. And in the defense that the Trump team put forward last year, they made a number of specific claims about the way they'd used Electric Avenue, which they reckoned ticked some boxes and meant that this was fair use and no license was required.
Yeah, specifically, Trump's motion to dismiss argued that his use of Electric Avenue was transformative, as I've already said, and comedic, both of which are grounds for a fair use claim. In the motion, Trump's lawyers said a reasonable observer would perceive that the campaign video uses the song for a comedic, political purpose, a different and transformed purpose from that of the original song. Moreover, in light of the obvious comedic or satirical nature of the campaign video, a reasonable observer would regard it as criticism or commentary.
Now, it has to be said, those claims that the Trump team put in last year, they always seem somewhat optimistic, because it was a straight sync. Basically, it was a video with some animation, and as we've already mentioned, there were some Joe Biden clips as well. But I mean, basically, they took Electric Avenue, they synchronized it into the animation, a big chunk of the song was played across the video, and yes, it was synchronized to the video, and yes, there were some Joe Biden quotes landed on top. But I mean, it was a straight sync. So to suggest that that was transformative in some way would greatly extend the definition of transformative, and in essence would mean that any politician could synchronize any track into a video and wouldn't need permission. So I think that would set a dangerous precedent, and therefore it seemed from the start that this was, who'd afford it from a Donald Trump lawyer? This was a pretty weak and ambitious argument to put forward.
Yeah, so last week the judge was actually only ruling on the motion to dismiss and not whether or not this use was indeed fair use. In fact, the judge said that it was rarely appropriate for a judge to outright rule on something like fair use at this stage in a case, given the complexity of the fair use principle. That said, this judge did have some quite critical comments on the claim that it was transformative or fair use. He wrote, "The video's creator did not edit the song's lyrics, vocals, or instrumentals at all, and the song is immediately recognizable when it begins playing around the 15-second mark of the video, notwithstanding that audio of President Biden's speech can be heard simultaneously. Electric Avenue is not edited at all and is instantly recognizable. The addition of audio of President Biden's speech does nothing to obscure the song, and the song, which plays for over two-thirds of the duration of the video, is a major component of the impression created by the animation, even though it appears that the video's creator could have chosen nearly any other music to serve the same entertaining purpose."
Meanwhile, when the Trump team were talking about the comedic value of this campaign video, they're kind of there alluding to the idea that parody is fair use, as I've already mentioned. In other countries where we don't have a wide concept like fair use, it is still quite common for parody to be covered by a copyright exception. But on sort of the comedic parody elements, supposed, of this video, the judge said in his ruling, the animation does not use Electric Avenue as a vehicle to deliver its satirical message, and it makes no effort to poke fun at the song or Grant. And actually, under the US fair use principle, it is often said that to count as parody, the way the song has been used needs to be parodying the creator of the song or somebody involved in the creation or the release of the song. So it's not enough for you to write some lyrics in a parody song that's mocking somebody that has nothing to do with the song. Actually, the satire somehow has to be linked to somebody connected to the song itself. Under the US principle, that's not necessarily the case elsewhere in the world. But I mean, this video didn't do any of that. It was basically just synchronizing the track in, and the judge concluded, the fact the video on the whole constitutes political messaging does not by itself support a finding of transformative use.
So considering all that, Trump's motion to dismiss was denied, although his team could still use that fair use argument further down the line, because obviously it's proven so successful so far. It doesn't seem very likely that they'd succeed with those arguments at any other stage in the case, even if they do decide to present it again, perhaps with more evidence and a more rigorous discussion in court. But I mean, as you said, if they were able to win just on the fair use argument, then that would kind of mean that any politician could use any song in a video and just say it was fair use. And we know from countless social media complaints and legal claims by artists, artists really don't like it when politicians just go around using their music without permission.
Yeah, it's already annoying that there's some ambiguities around the blanket licenses when it comes to political rallies and events. Imagine if there was a fair use get out when it comes to synchronizing music into political videos. So I don't think those arguments are going to work. If this case proceeds, if it gets a full-on court hearing down the line, I would imagine at some point a check will be written and this will be settled. But we will see. Meanwhile, a legal rep working for Grant welcomed last week's judgment.
Yes, one of Grant's attorneys, Brian Kaplan, told Law 360, the decision serves to send a message that recording artists and songwriters' creative output cannot be arbitrarily usurped by politicians who wish to avoid obtaining permission to use their recordings and pay appropriate licensing fees.
And so the case continues, although, as I say, I suspect this is another case that will ultimately fizzle out, but in Eddie Grant's case, hopefully fizzle out with a nice check and some damages for the use of his song. But we will see, maybe Donald Trump's lawyers will return with some other fair use or copyright arguments down the line. And if so, it will be interesting to see what those arguments might be.
And finally, on this edition of Setlist, last month was the 30th anniversary of the release of Nirvana's Nevermind album, just over a week ago, if you're listening to this podcast as it goes out. And to celebrate that, lawyers for the man who was photographed as a baby for the record's cover have demanded that that image be edited on all future re-releases of the album, basically in some way covering up his genitals.
So as you say, that statement was issued to coincide with the 30th anniversary of the release of Nevermind. But it wasn't a complete surprise that statement came out, because this follows an interesting, again, some would argue slightly ambitious, but nevertheless, an interesting lawsuit that was actually filed while we were on our Setlist summer holiday, so we didn't talk about it on the podcast. But that was litigation filed by Spencer Eldon, who is the guy who is pictured as a baby, a very young baby, on that very famous album artwork. And he filed a lawsuit earlier this summer against Nirvana themselves, against their label, against various other people who were involved in the creation of that famous artwork, basically saying that as a result of that artwork being out there for the last 30 years, that has caused him significant emotional distress, and he is now seeking damages for the use of that photo, which in the lawsuit it was claimed His guardians at the time when the photograph was taken, obviously he is naked in the photo as a very young baby. The allegation is that his guardians did not know what the photo was going to be used for. There was never permission given, and that over the last 30 years, he has suffered damage as a result of that picture being out there. And not only does he want it edited in future releases, which we'll come back onto in a moment, the lawsuit is also seeking some significant damages for the emotional distress that it has caused.
Yeah, and that lawsuit made some pretty bold claims. I mean, the centerpiece of it being the accusation that the Nevermind artwork constitutes commercial child pornography under US law, and that defendants therefore knowingly produced, possessed, and advertised commercial child pornography depicting Spencer, and they knowingly received value in exchange for doing so.
Now, when that lawsuit was filed earlier this summer, it actually sparked quite a lot of debate within the legal community because of those bold claims that it is making. And also, I mean, a lot of people, both within the legal side and also within the media, who were commenting on that lawsuit. Well, I mean, one thing that lots of people pointed out is that this guy, Spencer Eldon, has spoken about him being the Nevermind baby and being on that famous Nirvana artwork. He's spoken about it a number of times over the years. He is generally in the past, although not 100% consistently, but certainly with the first few interviews he gave, I guess when he was a teenager, he was actually quite blasé about it. Although there was an interview from a few years ago where he was a little bit more negative about the impact that it has on his life. And of course, at various points over the last 30 years, he has famously recreated the photo, and those images have done the rounds on social media. I mean, albeit in the recreation, he is wearing shorts. But I mean,
yes, although there was one interview where he suggested taking the shorts off, and it was the photographer who said, "I don't think that's necessary."
And it's not just one recreation photo. There are a number, because obviously sometimes people put them all together, don't they, to show him getting older as the photos have progressed. So therefore, lots of discussion about the lawsuit, some considering this argument that the photo and the use of the photo was somehow child pornography and whether that could possibly be the case under the definition of that in US law. And then other people sort of questioning why it's taken this long for him to take action and citing those more blasé comments that he's made about the photo over the years and the fact that he has willingly recreated it on multiple occasions.
So with that lawsuit itself, Eldon is seeking damages for the use of that image over the last 30 years. But the more recent update in the story was that on the actual 30th anniversary date, Eldon's lawyers said in a statement, "Today, like each year on this date, our client Spencer Eldon has to brace himself for a renewed unwanted attention from the media and fans alike throughout the world. This is a choice that he's never had," they went on. "It has been thrust upon him, and for 30 years he has dealt with its devastating and painful consequences. Our message to Nirvana is clear. Redact the image of Mr. Eldon's genitalia from all future album covers."
And of course, given the fact that it is, or recently was, the 30th anniversary of the album, there are some re-releases upcoming. I mean, they're already on sale. I sort of suspect that they've probably already been manufactured and printed. I don't know. But there are some very imminent 30th anniversary re-releases coming up, which I guess, if they were going to respond positively to this request by Eldon's lawyers, they would do something to the artwork on those releases. I don't know. It's been interesting reading the way that different people have responded to this whole dispute, both from a legal perspective, but then also journalists who are kind of saying, well, why after 30 years are you coming out now and saying this, given that you've been quite blasé about it over the years, and can there possibly be a case for getting megabucks damages out of all of this? But then I sort of feel that whatever the arguments in the past, whatever the law says, whether or not there is a legal case, some people would argue that there isn't really a legal case to be answered here, whether or not damages are due. I mean, changing what you do moving forward in a way is slightly different, isn't it? And if he is saying that this really upsets me, then I'm not saying that anybody should necessarily accept any liabilities that went before, who knows, but maybe they could make some changes moving forward. I mean, one of the allegations, and I think this was in the lawsuit, it isn't just from stories over the years, was that there was originally a suggestion all the way back in 1991 that the genitals would be obscured on the album anyway in the original release, possibly with a parent advisory sticker or something like that. Obviously, that didn't happen, but I don't know. Maybe the debate about what you do with this artwork and this image moving forward is different to the legal debate about what went before and whether or not there are any legal liabilities.
Yeah, I suppose you could separate those two things. Although, I mean, the lawyers seem to have made this statement as a kind of a way to keep the press attention on their lawsuit rather than, I mean, I don't want to say lawyers don't have genuine concern, but I mean, it does seem like an album that's already sold 30 million copies saying now we want you to put a sticker on this. I mean, it seems a little bit late, and the many millions more copies of that image online already, I mean, it's not going to have a great effect on the number of people who see that picture. I mean, the lawsuit's interesting because it makes this claim that it's child pornography. They're going to have to prove in court, I would assume, that that image is sexual in nature. I think their argument is that the baby chasing the dollar bill makes it look like a stripper. And I think Nirvana would say that was not the intention of that image at all. But, you know, whether or not that can be proven in court, I mean, it does seem optimistic somewhat.
Yeah, I would agree. The lawsuit itself is very optimistic, but in terms of meeting him halfway with regards to future re-releases, I mean, you're right. It is kind of very much closing the stable door after the horse has bolted. So many people have that album. That image is in so many places on the internet. On one level, you're totally right. What difference does it make if, you know, a relatively limited edition box set gets sold to some super fans with the artwork on in the context of how wide that image is available? It doesn't really make any difference. Although then the flip side is, if it makes him feel happier, it's not actually that big an ask to come up with some new artwork for future distribution of this album. So maybe I'm just trying to be Mr. Compromise on all of this.
Yeah, well, to be fair to him, a lot of people, I think probably myself included, have said, well, he's been pretty blasé about this for 30 years. Why change? Now, that said, you could be blasé about something as a teenager and maybe in your 20s, and then in your 30s go, actually, I don't like that, and I don't like this attention. And maybe, I mean, the fact that he's done all these interviews over the years is partly the reason that he gets all the attention, because if he hadn't mentioned it, probably, you know, no one's going to know that it was him. But now he's probably at a stage in his life where that comes up quite frequently, and maybe now he doesn't really want to talk about it anymore. And so I can see how he could, whereas, you know, I think there's a lot of people saying, well, this is just someone trying to get some money now late in the day. I think that it's fair to say that someone could get to a point in their life where this sort of thing was a bit annoying and did start to upset them. And so perhaps his claims now are legitimate, and perhaps, maybe you're right. Maybe Nirvana should say, all right, for this re-release, we will cover things up and then we can just discuss it in court. I think the issue there would then be that once they got to court, the lawyers would say, well, they covered it up for the re-release. Obviously, they know they've done something wrong.
So we will see. We are yet to even get a response to the lawsuit. There was no response to last week's statement. So we will see. Obviously, they have to respond to the lawsuit. So that should be coming our way quite soon. So it'll be interesting to see what Nirvana and the label and all the other people involved in that cover, first of all, what they say about the legal arguments, and also whether they dispute the version of events and the circumstances that led to the creation and use of that cover as described in the original lawsuit, whether or not they dispute that as well. So we may well be coming back to this story again on a future edition of Setlist.
Yeah, but that's all we've got time for on this episode. If you want to go and read more about anything we've discussed on this edition of the show, go and look at the show notes where we'll have links to everything we've talked about. You can find those at setlistpodcast.com or in whatever podcast player you're listening to us in now. While you're holding that podcast player in your hand, you might as well just give the subscribe button a little tap, and that'll improve your life massively. If you haven't already tapped that button, you should. It's really good. It will make you 27% happier. And you could, hey, you've got it in your hand, this podcast app. Why not rate us and review us while you're there? And then if you've got anything else to say while you're at it, you could open up your mail app and email us, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Tell us anything, anything at all. We're open to just chat. But yeah, you can keep it specific to the show if you want. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Moulton, Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.